So you guys, why don't we start up a little bit here? And since we, exactly, and that's good. That's good. That's the whole point, to become unified here.
I'll behave.
So anyway, we're going to – people are checking in. I've been down there trying to recruit people. I know Ed's down there right now, Ed Crespin. He's trying to get people to come here as well. So when we get to the panel, the room will be more full. But I did want to start and just have a little talk with everybody about why it's important to be involved and connected and organized. And we really hope that people can spread the word in general to the consumers to get connected to us, because it's such a part of their livelihood. I mean, the Department of Rehab, I know from working there, we're never short of problems and issues to deal with. And there's also just issues in the private sector that need to be dealt with as well, but we can be there to help as well, and come together on all these problems that confront us. You know, the main reason that there is this rehab committee, and I'm actually very, very happy I'm the rehab chair. It's, at first I didn't really want to, and I was like, no, please leave me alone. But I was talked into it, and now I'm really happy, actually. And I feel like it's such a great way to be a part of this committee in order to make social change. And, you know, our whole point in this rehab committee is to bring about independence for the visually impaired and blind consumer, and also to help make sure they're getting employed. And, you know, it's such a great mission, knowing that 72% of people who are visually impaired and blind are unemployed. And if that doesn't get you going, get you stirred up for the day, I mean, I don't know what kind of passions we would have to come up with for you. But the main thing is that, you know, I wanted to just go through a few things about why this has been such a great committee to be connected to. Last year, we wrote a resolution on Human Wear and Freedom Scientific. And this committee was in support of it, and we took it to the membership. The membership voted it in. And we wrote it saying that Human Wear and Freedom Scientific were not providing us with quality technology. Their products were poor, and their customer support was poor. And I would get phone calls on my job all day long from consumers complaining about it all. So we wrote the resolution. We got it passed. We did try to meet with these entities beforehand, of course, just to see if they would really work with us, and they wouldn't, so we took it to a resolution. When that happened, Human Wear did meet with us and really, really wanted to take great efforts to improve. And I really commend them. They really came to us heartfelt, with a lot of integrity, and they worked with a lot of diligence to make improvements. And they still want to work with us to continue that relationship. And this year, we're going to turn things around, and we're going to write a resolution to thank Human Wear, and that's some of the things that we can do here in terms of social change. And, you know, I have to say, Freedom has not come to the table with us. They have not worked with us, and that's just a sad day. And you don't really want to get me going on all that. But, you know, we still can do things to help our consumers the best we can. And other things that we've done here that I'm really proud we've done as a committee is, last fall in October, we wrote a resolution on our procurement problems at the Department of Rehabilitation. There was a lot of legislation that was very cumbersome. We were fearing that it was going to bring about, when anything is written that cumbersome, you can almost guarantee there's going to be delays in service, because it's going to be very confusing and nobody knows what's what. So anyway, we wrote a resolution on it that we were fearing that it was going to delay services for the consumer. And long behold, you know, some people thought we were jumping the gun, writing the resolution too early. But long behold, it did happen to me on my job, where a consumer was delayed 2 weeks in order to retain their job from that process. And I worked every angle I could figure out to jump the system. And you know what? Even with that, he was delayed 2 weeks. And so I said to myself, we didn't jump the gun. And that we still, the letter, the resolution went to Gary Kurbara. He's now our head person at the Department of Rehab, since we don't have a director in place right now. And he responded to us, and he did have, as a result of that, and I'm sure other people complaining about the issues as well, but he had the chief of our procurement services, Doug Sale, who's excellent, and Tim Ford, as many of you may know, who's also excellent. He's a person who's blind, and he's a lawyer, and he works for the state, and he's been a very important part of helping smooth over our procurement process at the Department of Rehabilitation just throughout time. So they went over, Tim Ford and Doug Sale went over to the Department of General Services, who started this bureaucratic mess, right? So now this is the good gossip. It looks like they've got it to put us in for an exemption in the state of California. This was a blanket rule sent out to all state agencies that you needed to follow these procurement rules when getting anything through the state. But it didn't work for us at the Department of Rehabilitation because we have such individualized services. We're not buying massive computers for, you know, such and such state agency. So this was not going to be a process that worked for us, but it looks like there's other people on the exemption list as well, and it looks like maybe, hopefully by July, I'm hoping, things could turn around. And so that's the kind of importance that this group coming together can do, putting our voices to the table. And another great thing, I know that there's another resolution that's going to be put on the table at this convention, and it is about freezes to rates for many of the private agencies. I know that so many of the agencies out there have, let's say they want to get their orientation mobility instructor rates raised. Right now, that is not going to happen. I can tell you at the Lyons Center, I think it's $40 an hour. That's in the Bay Area. That's pretty low. You cannot afford to pay your electricity bills and your staff. And those people are important resources to us, and that's what we're all here together to do, to make sure that our resources stay in place. So we're there for everybody, and we hope that if you have problems, you'll come to us so that we can help you. And it's not always that as a consumer or as, you know, people in the trenches or on the front line or the ones kicking it up, this entire rehab committee has been important even for the people, say, at the top of our Department of Rehabilitation. I know Catherine Campisi, recently we've been complaining about our computers at work, how they're really sluggish and they're freezing, and it's been going on for a long time, you know, for some years, but since August it's been very pronounced. And she has acknowledged it, and the leaders at the Department of Rehabilitation have acknowledged it, and she had contacted Jeff Tom, because of course you can't go back down to me and just say, hey, Tricia Leitz, as a counselor, can you come out and speak in front of the legislature? Doesn't work that way in a line of authority. But she can go to Jeff Tom, our president, the president of California Council of the Blind, and say, I need a counselor to come out in front of the legislature and speak about this problem so we can get this fixed. And anyway, I was expected to do that this morning, but Catherine Campisi called Dan Kaiser and said, no longer do we have to go out and do that because it has been passed, that they're going to get a new electronic recording system at the Department of Rehabilitation. Yeah. So we can be there for our leaders as well to come out and to do good too. So we're really one big group. Sometimes I see the system as this, almost like there's nobody's responsible for anything, and then the system gets kind of cold and in balance and disconnected. And I think our voices are so important to come together, and this is a great committee to make that happen. So I hope this gets you thinking about consumers that you may know to get connected, because we really, really want the consumer to be connected. We want to hear their voice and to help them. And we also want to help any of you that are just involved with rehab in general. And obviously, the people that are here today all care deeply about it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. And, you know, all of your voices are important. If you don't want to join, you know, as a member, it's okay. We're here for you anyway. We want to work with you to see what we can do to help your agencies, your issues wherever you're at. You know, if you're working in the government, if you're a consumer, you need help, we're here for you. Sure. Yeah.
This is Christy. Uh-huh. Do you want to talk about AB 489?
No, because I don't know what it is.
AB 489 is our AFSCME union bill to do studies and to bring our salaries up to within, I think it's 5% or 10%, I can't remember which now, market rate.
Mm-hmm.
Our bill is being heard by, I don't know which committee, I think it's the PERS, on Wednesday, April 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And so all rehab counselors should be knowing about this, but if you're in the Bay Area, Sacramento area, and you can come and wear your union T-shirts, that would be most profitable, I guess, for us, because they need to see numbers at that committee hearing.
Thanks a lot. That's very important to us, actually. And we do a lot of hard work at the Department of Rehabilitation, and it's sometimes it may seem like we're the jerks, but many of us that want to try to smooth things over are here today. And I know Christy's been a counselor in the past. Her husband's a counselor. Are there any other counselors out there today from the department?
Therese.
Who? Oh, excellent. Good. I'm so glad you came. Yay. Good. Thanks. And anyone else? Is Teresa and Richard, you're here. What are you saying? Welcome. Okay. Yes.
Would it be appropriate, since a lot of us, well, most of us don't see well.
Yes.
Some of us, present company included, don't hear well.
Yeah.
It would be very interesting to me if people would stand and identify themselves and say where they work and where they live.
Okay, let's go around and just do that real quick. Do you want to start with you, Dan, up in front?
I'm Dan Kaiser, and I work for the California Council of the Blind.
And then I guess is that you, Richard, in the corner? Then you want to go over there?
Yeah, Richard Retta, Department of Rehab, Oakland and Fremont, School for the Blind.
I'm Linda Farrell. I'm the president of San Francisco chapter, and I work at San Francisco Vocational Services.
Welcome.
I'm Winifred Downey, and I am from San Francisco chapter.
Yeah, Pete Benavides, good afternoon, everybody.
Oh, I'm good.
CEO for Blindness Support Services in Riverside.
Mm-hmm.
And Christian,
yay.
Of Oak Rehab, San Bernardino.
Good.
Christy Crespin, Patton State Hospital, Highland or Patton, California, social worker.
My name is Jeff with Jackson. I'm from San Diego with the San Diego Borough Club.
You are?
Oh, me. Oh, I'm Therese Gardner. I'm with the Department of Rehabilitation, Modesto.
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 And you are?
Linda Bass from Teachers Sacramento.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Hi. I'm Kathy Scow. I'm an orientation mobility instructor at the Orientation Center for the Blind.
And Donna Brown's.
And Donna Brown's on the side.
And I'm,
oh, thank you.
I'm Cy Tarlin, also an orientation mobility instructor at OCB in Albany.
The lady next to you?
Hi. I'm Kathy Morales. I'm a student at Orientation Center.
Welcome, Kathy.
Yay.
I'm Pamela Metz. I'm president of the Greater LA chapter, married to one of the chair members of the right now.
Which one?
I'm going to be in house life.
I'm Aisha McKinney, a member of Long Beach chapter, and also president of GDS, Guide Dog Support, Long Beach.
My name is Robert Wint, and I'm a third counselor at Cal State Long Beach.
Great.
I'm Joe Smith, and I work for Blindfield Services in Sacramento.
And they told me they're keeping an eye on me back there. So
I found that very helpful.
What? That was excellent, is right. It's good to know who's all here. And you know, like I say, just spread the word to consumers to get involved with us. We really, really want more involvement from the people who are directly affected, and we would love to hear their voices so we can make sure we're really helping people the way we want to help them. So, as we are rolling along here, I think Priscilla from Society for the Blind said she couldn't make it over till about 1:30, and I'm not sure what time it is right now.
1:30.
Now, I did state on the agenda. Let's see, what did I say on the agenda? I said 1:45 we'd begin the panel. But does anybody have anything else they want to say before we begin the panel about maybe how it's been important for them to get involved or get connected or what they would like to see as a person who's come today?
Trish is Pamela Mills. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. I want to start my own business. My husband knows all about it.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard of it.
Don't you quote me. Of course, hospitals and clinics and stuff like that. Blind, teaching staff how to work with blind patients, but also teaching the blind to advocate for themselves in hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I'm having with my rehab counselor, and I love him to death,
mm-hmm.
is that he says that I cannot get any help from rehab unless
you call the director. No, I'm
kidding.
Okay.
So unless I go through, is it a job developer or something like that?
It's business plan.
It's business plan.
Developer.
Oh, yes, okay.
Is that true? Do I have to do it that way?
Yep.
And what's your business again?
It's going to be called Geek Your Life.
Consulting.
You're consulting? Uh-huh.
Yes.
Oh, self-employment.
Typically, self-employment, there is a plan we work with. We hire consultants, a business consultant, to work with you to help build that plan. It is important because, of course, we want you to succeed at it and make money. And some of the business consultants are excellent that I've worked with. And there are times, though, that we can set people up, say, as contractors on some scenarios out there, like, I've done it with a person who's like a massage therapist. Instead of making them have a business plan, it's like, we'll just have you, you know. A lot of times I'm setting them up as contractors, maybe for another business or something like that. So I don't, if you get involved sometimes with that whole business plan thing, it can get to be a lot. But sometimes it's appropriate, and sometimes you're going to want to access those resources associated with a business plan. I do. I think that it's best to sit with a consultant who is very fair, who's set up businesses before in the past, and really, really can work with you to make sure that you're going
to
make money.
Okay. I'll talk to Mr.
Benavides. Where are you going, Mr. Benavides?
Water.
All right. Oh, yeah.
Trisha.
Yes.
I don't need the mic's here, and I don't need it right now.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the concerns I have, Mike's moving it over to me, so I'll use it then.
A little bit.
One of the real concerns I have is, well, even looking at the audience here, somehow over the last 20, 30 years, and it has been that long,
mm-hmm.
I'm finding that people, and especially consumers, have become more and more complacent.
Mm-hmm.
Either they're satisfied with what they're getting, or they'll go around to other people and complain, and I won't use the other B word at this point. I'll be nice. But they do. They'll complain, oh, rehab hasn't done this, rehab hasn't done that, or this one didn't do this, when push comes to shove. And they have organizations, consumer organizations, to go to, especially for, well, part of it, especially for that purpose. They don't show up. And I don't know how we get them. I think somehow for the few that are here that are in college or in other training programs, you guys have to really be the mouthpiece. We can do so much, but if we can try and answer questions, or if we can help you write a resolution because of something that you really feel is important, and yes, you do have to sell it to us as well. We need to know that what you're saying is really making sense and that it has some good meaning behind it, that it's really going to assist other people in their future. That does include rehab until they've completed all their training and until they are working. We're not going to get as far as we really could go. It takes the rest of the folks. You know, I guess Hillary said it takes a village. But, and it does. It, you know, we always talk, oh, this blind guy did this, this blind guy did that. But we never come together and figure out ways, and I'm talking about the people who need the services. We know what's needed. If we've been counselors, if we work at any of the training facilities, a lot of us really know what's needed out there. But we need to have the rest of you out there with us. Numbers, believe it or not, do make a difference. And without hearing all of your complaints and all of your issues, except one at a time, as you go down the street and meet somebody, oh, you know, I had a problem with rehab. That doesn't help us. It needs to be out in the open, needs to be out in public. And you guys out there who are using the service, not those of us that have worked within and so on and so forth, you guys who are using the service need to sort of be your own mouthpiece. Bring it up to us, and we can go forward. Join our organization in CCB. We can go forward with these things. But it does make a lot of sense to me that when these bills are brought to legislators and stuff, we need to start cramming those galleries in the Assembly and in the Senate and go to these committee hearings and doing the things that we try to push for you, because it really makes a whole lot more sense.
Yes.
There's a hand raised here.
Okay.
Dan,
go ahead, yeah.
You can all hear me. I am really concerned that we're asking for higher salaries for O&M people, but we're not mandating the type of training that they get for these agencies. And I'm sick and tired of going to a particular agency that is in my hometown that will not accept they're prejudiced against guide dogs, mm-hmm. and they almost got my wife killed because they don't have standardized O&M training.
Mm-hmm.
I think before we start asking for higher salaries, and those are important, okay, I'm not
mm-hmm.
saying they're not important,
mm-hmm.
but we need to get better standards for these agencies. If rehab's going to contract out to these agencies,
mm-hmm.
we need to have standards in California for O&M.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your voice in this. And that's the kind of involvement we do want to see and hear from people. And if you hear of people out there that want to get connected to us, please have them contact me. I'd be happy to start helping them get connected with all of us. I think we should start this panel. And so, Peter, do you want to come up and then... why don't you come
Lobster.
To the front here. And
okay.
Okay.
So,
hear about it. We're going to do this panel, and I'll tell you the format of the panel. After we have the panel discussion, we're going to discuss resolution, but I just wanted to have Paul to stay for that, too, because Elmer Chapson is going to do a little bit of history for us about rehabilitation resolutions that have been historic. So... it could be really interesting for those of you who like history, and we're just going to talk about some current resolutions that we would like to do, too.
Can you turn your microphone up, please?
Oh, you know what? I'm not talking in a microphone.
Here,
maybe
can I be heard?
Do you want this one?
Can everybody hear okay?
I don't know how to get it out of this delay. Here you go.
Yeah, we are.
Here you go, Trish.
Okay. Okay, I'm really sorry. Here, Elmer, do you want to make something?
You want me to go ahead with the historical?
Not yet, but right after this panel, we're going to do that. But I just wanted you guys to all stick around for Elmer, because he definitely is going to be really fascinating in his talk about how we've written resolutions throughout time on the Department of Rehabilitation and other issues and where we're at with it today. And then we'll bring up some current issues around rehab that we'd like to address at this convention with some resolutions. So that's always a very important part of any convention that you go to is the resolutions. And, of course, we want to have great discussions and put things on the table to allay anything before we go to a resolution. And this is a great format today that we're going to do so that we can have a lot of discussion and questions and answers to anything you want to know about residential centers. Our panelist here is Patty Maffei from the Living Skills Center. And Patty, what's your title there? And she's the program director. We have Peter Benavides. He is the CEO of Blindness Support Services. We have Ken Metz from DPI. And what's your title?
Director of DPI.
Director of DPI he is. And we have Mike Cole from the Orientation Center for the Blind, and he is the director there. So here's the format. Basically, we're just going to go down the line. And I'm really sorry the Society for the Blind isn't here. Maybe they left me a message and I just didn't get it today. But I think we should begin nonetheless. And the format's going to go as follows. Our committee has come up with questions that they'd like the centers to answer. One, the first question is going to be, how do you apply and get accepted to your center? And then we'll just go, we can start with Mike, Ken, Patty, and then Peter. And then this next question will be, well, after you answer those questions, we'll go back to the audience for questions and discussion. So, and then the next question is going to be, what do you do when you're at the centers? And then we'll do the same lineup. Go Mike, Ken, Patty, and Peter. And then we'll go back to the audience for discussion, questions, and answers. Then the last question is going to be, what does each center do for employment? And the panelists will go as follows, and then back to the audience for questions and answers and discussion. And we hope to make this a very meaningful event. And, you know, comparing and contrast we thought would be interesting, and just putting everything on the table if people have extra things they want to add. Okay, so let's start with the first question, which is, how do you apply and get accepted to your center? And I guess we'll start with Mike.
Hi. Well, okay. I'm assuming that everybody here knows what OCB is, so we'll just jump into the questions. And OCB, but I will tell you this, OCB is a program of the Department of Rehab. In other words, we are state employees who work there, and the budget for the Department of Rehab includes us as a budget item. So when somebody comes to OCB, it isn't so much a matter of someone off the street applying. What happens is the person has an open case with a rehab counselor, and as part of the person's individual plan for employment, they and their counselor may arrive at the decision that some kind of intense training should happen. You notice I'm speaking in kind of vague terms, because I think a lot of times a good IPE leaves a lot of room for maneuver. So it's decided that intense training is a good idea. Maybe it's even decided the kind of intense training. And it may turn out that OCB is a place that looks like a pretty good match for somebody seeking the kind of training that we offer. So in that instance, we are recommended, the client and the consumer and the counselor agree that this would be a good thing. And in essence, the counselor applies for or with the consumer. Now, what's the technical side of that? They submit to us the counselor submits to us a referral form. It's not exhaustive or comprehensive, but it kind of opens the door. It sort of tells us something about the person. And some of the areas on there that we pay particular attention to is why did you choose this method of training or this particular program? And another thing is, does the person have a place to return to? It's very tempting. I think maybe some of the other residential rehab centers may have this thought too. It's very tempting in this day and age to try to solve a lot of social problems with a residential solution. Unfortunately, OCB is a residential solution, but a very temporary one. A person stays at OCB for a time, but then at the end of that time, we're not a residential facility. I can't even say that we're particularly well connected as far as moving people into residences. And we do live in a time of rather shocking homelessness. So in any case, we're not a place to get in out of the cold, really, although that is a benefit. There's three meals a day and no rent and all that good stuff. But anyway, to summarize the process, a referral form is submitted, and we look it over, and we also like to know that someone is at least physically as able as they're going to be. So a thing we sometimes check into, especially if somebody has a very serious medical condition, say, for example, very serious diabetes, is we would like to know what kind of diabetic control the person has, because, well, you know, we don't want them to be so ill they can't benefit and so on. And in most cases, we're really pretty easy. We want people to come to us, and the only thing we're doing is kind of making sure that we have a sense of the person. After all, they could be from any part of California, and we want to kind of get to know them. Now, a thing that we would like to do, too, where it's feasible, is have the person visit. And when they do, they tour around, and their tour guide is a student, so they can kind of talk to them about student stuff. And then if they're really a serious applicant, we sit down and have an interview with the person. Then we have a committee that is made up of we have a medical person. That's important only because there's a lot of very unusual medical conditions that we see, things that are not widely represented in, I mean, you know, blindness is a low incidence disability, but some of the ways people become visually impaired are really low incidence. Yeah, that's true. Some names I can't even think of. And then our rehabilitation counselor and I form this committee, and we review the stuff, and then we may turn back to the counselor if we just have some questions. And we've met the person, it looks like a fit, then we give them at least a proposed date. That's not a hard and fast date for either party, but, I mean, generally speaking, people need to make plans, because after all, they're going to actually, you know, move there for a while. And when I should say that when they do move there, you just share a room with somebody and a bathroom with a couple other people. So, you know, it's not like you're going to move your all your stuff, and there's talking going back and forth. So I think that pretty much reflects the process. And then people come, and they move in, and generally speaking, if it's feasible, people go home on weekends. Occasionally we have day students too, by the way, people who live close and or reasonably close and can, and for whatever reason, you know, need to attend OCB in that way. Okay? So I'll move on to Ken.
Great.
Hi, good afternoon. At the Davidson Program for Independence, which is part of the Junior Blind of America, it's interesting because what we do is we end up getting phone calls either from rehab counselors and or blind or visually impaired folks themselves, not counting the calls we get from other social workers, from prisons, from all sorts of areas. And we have an application that the person needs to fill out with all kinds of medical information. They have to have a TB test. I first try and get them to take a tour of our facility. Most of the time, I will actually take them on the tour because I like to try and determine to some extent what their stamina might be to make sure that they will really be able to walk several blocks at a time if they're going to be on an O&M lesson. And since all of you are out here know what O&M is, I don't need to explain it. And
I also like to get an idea of how healthy the person is just by talking with them, listening to them, asking them various questions. As soon as I get a phone call and an interest, I also email the rehab counselor. I do let the person know that they must have a counselor from the Department of Rehab in order to become a student at the Davidson program. So once we get the phone call, we then go and notify the rehab counselor. I send out a packet to that prospective student. We've set a date most of the time for the person to come and take a tour, again, if it's feasible. That, you know, obviously if they live in San Francisco or something, we've had a couple like that. Some of the rehab counselors will pay for them to come down for a day and take a tour to make sure that this is the right facility for them, and some won't. So, you know, we do our best. On occasion, we do take someone who hasn't taken a tour yet. I do my best to give a verbal explanation of our facilities and of our program. After the person has sent in all their medical information and sent in their arbitration agreement, sent in their income statement, and the income statement, by the way, is something that we have really for statistical purposes. They don't even have to put a name on those forms. We do that because what we get from the Department of Rehab in our case service contract is you know, about somewhere about 1.25 mil a year, and that does not cover the entire program. So we do constantly try and get other grants to make sure that we can supplement the program. Once all the papers are in, Shirley Manning, who's our Director of Adult Education Services, she gets those papers, checks to make sure they're all in properly. We'll contact both the counselor and the student to let them know a start date. And from that point, we also will notify the person if they'd like to come earlier. If we have a cancellation, we will consider them, and we set up a list for those who would like to come sooner. Most of the time, from the time we get the papers, right now we're at about 2 to 2.5 month waiting list. It's not really a lot because there is a lot of processing that has to go on. Usually folks like a little bit of notice before they have to leave. And again, our place is not it's not used as a refugee camp. We need to really do our best to make sure that people do have a residence to go back to. We do not keep folks in the dorm when we have 3-day weekends during the politically correct winter holiday, as we know it, is Christmas and New Year's. We do close down for that week. As a matter of fact, this year, because of when July 4th comes up on a Wednesday, we'll close down for that week. So they do have to have a home to go to. One of the other things that I do is to make certain, or that we do actually, is to make certain that when we get an application, I also now have some other things that we're trying to get from the rehab counselor, such as an IPE, to see how that's set up. I'm also interested now in getting any kinds of records pertaining to a person's criminal history, and that's actually more important than you can imagine. Especially when our campus has children on there, we have to be very, very careful. Now, I also know that some of our students in the past haven't even disclosed some of those things to the counsel, to the rehab counselor, and we only find out later on when they've told another student, or threatened them, or whatever it might be, or threatened one of us. I don't know. No, it hasn't gotten that bad. But the point is we do have obligations to our children, and that is an important thing for us because we are under the Children's Services, and so we, you know, while we have an adult facility there, we are part of the state adult residential facilities, and I'm going for my test for that next week, actually, to be certified. I already took the class. So anyway, it's interesting. So then the student does come to us. We try and determine ahead of time, you know, the age of the student. In some cases, we've had some students that even though we require sixth grade literacy, that's hard to find sometimes these days. And so, you know, we do bend a little bit. We're not real staunch on that, but eventually, if we find out that the person just cannot handle it, they might really be regional center people. And we do get some of those, and some, a couple of the regional center folks have been excellent. More often than not, though, they don't make it through the program. But we really try. We try and give people as much of an opportunity as possible, as long as we feel that they will be able to make it with the system, live with the other students. And in our dorm area, our dorm is set up in suites on the north side and the south side. On the south side is the female, the north side is the male. We have two stories. We have two suites at each end on each story, so it's four and four. Each suite has four individual bedrooms, a living room, and a bathroom. So up to four people will share a living room and a bathroom, but each one has their own bedroom and a key to that bedroom so that they can lock their door, make sure they can keep all their personal things personal. Whatever they want to keep in that room should really be theirs. And so those are some of the preparations that we need to make to prepare someone to finally come in as a student. And I think the best part is taking them in on the tour.
I think there's a question out here. Well, we're trying to hold our questions until after the panelists are all completed with the questions. Do you want to continue, Ken?
I'm done.
You are? Okay. So then it's Patty from the Living Skills Center.
Hi. It's kind of hard to talk about applying before you know a little bit about our center, but a lot of you out there I recognize and do know about the Living Skills Center. We're different. We're a private nonprofit, and we have a case service contract with the Department of Rehab. So our students are rehab clients. Many times they're referred by the Department of Rehab. Other times they find us online. They're referred by their teacher, a mother, heard from a cousin about our program, all different ways. So any way that they hear about us, they fill out an application. They can do that online, or they can call us for an application. And with that application, there are five release forms that they have to fill out and sign, and that is for their personal physician, their eye doctor, their rehab counselor, their orientation mobility instructor, and their teacher for the visually impaired. Now, maybe not all five of those are applicable to each particular applicant, but they just fill out the ones that apply to them. And then we send away for information, because we want to gather information about that person to try to determine if it's an appropriate setting. It's a very independent setting in that our folks are living in an apartment in the community. So there is no dorm. They're not being fed by anybody. In order to get in, they have to be over the age of 18. I already mentioned, be a client of the Department of Rehab. They have to be visually impaired, but they don't have to be legally blind. If the Department of Rehab feels that our center is an appropriate setting, and if we do our collecting of data and determine that it's an appropriate setting, then they can come. They do have to have an income, and it has to be fairly close to, most of our students are on SSI, but it takes about $1,000 a month to live in our program, because they're paying all of their own bills. And by doing that, they're learning how to pay their bills. So an income is important. And sometimes the Department of Rehab, if they're not getting high enough SSI, will help a little bit with that. Also, the Department of Rehab will give $130 a month for our students because the Bay Area expenses are high. Other disabilities are okay. Regional center's fine. They have to have the ability to make decisions in emergency situations so that they are not going to harm themselves or others if they respond badly. So how do we determine that? We gather information and we do an interview with them. And that can be over the phone, or that can be in person. For people who can make it to our center, we love to have them come and see us and do the interview in person. We get a better feel. And then after I gather all this information, and I run all the applications, I'm the program director, gather all the information, I do the interview with another teacher. Our teachers are very involved in the application process. And then the teachers vote about whether or not it's an appropriate setting. Every single teacher in the center votes. And one no will keep the person from coming. But our teachers hardly ever say no. So I don't vote because I'm not working with those folks, and the executive director does not vote. It's the teachers that do the voting. I'm just gathering the information for them. And the teacher that does the interview is also one who is very much giving input about how that should go. So if we vote yes, let me tell you reasons we might vote no. An arsonist would not be accepted into our center because they, you know, will burn down the place and cause us big problems. They have to be able to give themselves their own medication and not be medically frail. We don't have a nurse on site. It's a very independent program. We have a night supervisor, but he can go on vacation and he doesn't have to be there on the weekends. So they have to be pretty much okay when there's nobody around. They all have phone numbers to call for emergency situations, and the students all help each other. But we really want it to be a safe program. Safety is key at our place. Another reason they might not be accepted is just not, they don't have the income. We feel that they might be too developmentally delayed. Sometimes if we are wondering if the setting is appropriate, we might refer them to another agency, and that might be OCB and it might be DPI, to get some skills before they come to us or to even determine if that would be appropriate. However, most of the time, you know, we don't need to refer to another agency. Our program is totally individualized, so we're able to handle any level of skills that people have. Then, if they are accepted, they go on to our wait list, and we wait for an appropriate time for them to come in. Our students can stay up to a year, and they're living in apartments with a roommate. So, you know, they might have a little bit of a wait. And we want to balance our caseload, so we want to make sure that you know, people with a lot of skills are mixed in with people that have higher needs so that our staff can handle that. And everybody comes on a 3-month trial basis because we're making our best guess when they come, but it doesn't always work. Usually it does. We're really good about determining that whether or not they can come to us. They do need a TB test, and sometimes people have problems getting to a doctor before they come to us. The requirement for the TB test is new for us. If they just can't get it done before they come to us, then we'll help them get it done. We are a year-round facility. We don't close for any holidays. They can live there. They're paying rent in their own apartment, so they can stay there. The teachers will take Christmas and Thanksgiving off. You know, it's not that the teachers are there, but the students can stay. However, we do have the same situation where people try to use us because they don't have a home, and we will not accept anybody into our program who does not have a place to go if it doesn't work out. Because it's, as you probably all know, it's really, really difficult if it doesn't work out and suddenly you are making the person homeless. So we don't want to get in that situation. So that's our application process. Okay. Peter? Get this over on the other side of the water. There you go.
All right. Thank you very much. Greetings, everybody. You know, first of all, I want to thank Patricia and her committee for putting this panel together. For a couple reasons, I think it's important for the audience to get a feel of what happens in the private side of things or state-run side of things in the field of direct services for blind and visually impaired people in our state, from north to the south and everywhere in between. And so I want to thank you, Patricia, for doing that. I feel honored and privileged to sit on this panel with my colleagues in the business, because it's good for us to do so because I feel that we too learn. We who provide the direct services, whether it's via contract, case service contract as described by Patty, or the process that Ken described over at the Davidson Program for Independence, or what Mike Cole does at OCB. It's challenging for us sometimes, and it's good for us to be in this position to have a dialogue with folks so that we too can learn. And yes, when at times needed, receive criticisms on how we operate our programs. It's a constant learning process for us as we do everything that we can under sometimes trying conditions, whether it's financial situations, a shortage of available personnel that are skillful and knowledgeable about the field of blindness. We struggle with that, and we try our best to maintain a quality staff to provide the utmost of services to the clients that we are so privileged to serve, and I do mean that. A little bit about myself. I'm a little impatient. In fact, flying up and taking a taxi from the airport to here, I had the opportunity to ride with Christy and Ed, and we were just sharing different things about ourselves. And I did say I'm an impatient person, and I like to get things done. Except for situations like this, I don't mind being last. I think it's a little advantage because I don't really have to be the one who has to initiate the conversation. So it's kind of easier for me to do so. Blindness Support Services, and I'll refer to us as BSS, incorporated May of 1992. So we're almost reaching 15 years in the business. And what I like about sitting up here with my colleagues is it's nice to know how diverse our programs are. Yes, we have a lot of similarities. And yes, we have some differences, but I look at those differences as diversity, and I think diversity is extremely important. Just look at California from a demographic standpoint, and we all know and we all recognize the diversity that our state has as a people. And I think those of us who are in the direct service side of things, we need to recognize that and make sure that as we develop our programs, that we're able to provide services to a diverse population. And we at BSS, we try to do that through a number of ways, which of course includes staff with various bilingual capabilities. So we pride ourselves in that, and we think it's critical, especially as California moves in the direction that it's moving. Like the Living Skills Center, BSS has a case service contract with the Department of Rehabilitation. We had it since July of 1998. For the contract services that we do provide, we have an intake process. And the intake process is similar to what you've heard, with various degrees of differences. But, you know, rather than bore you with those specifics, because it's an intake process is what it is. We receive an application, interest, we have an interview, we make a decision whether or not that individual qualifies to take part in the programs that we have under case service contract. And those include orientation and mobility, rehabilitation technology, activities of daily living, otherwise known as independent living skills training, and employment preparation, job development and placement. And I guess I'll refer to those later as we answer the next questions. There's an option for those that are interested in going to BSS for services. They could live at our residential facility, which is known as Canyon Shadows, or they can just live in their own home and commute to and from our different training facilities. Canyon Shadows, in 1996, December, BSS became its managing general partner. Canyon Shadows is a 120-unit apartment complex in the city of Riverside. In order to for a consumer to be accepted into living at Canyon Shadows, they must apply directly at Canyon Shadows, not through BSS. We have a management team that serves as exactly that. So an individual wishing to live in Canyon Shadows must apply and go through the credit check, criminal background check, and must meet certain income criteria. Canyon Shadows was set up to address affordable housing initially. It's very expensive to live here in California, one of the most expensive states in the world to live. And so as we developed the project through tax credits and various governmental programs, the caveat was that folks with either low or moderate income can qualify to live at the facility. So I would say as of today, I believe only 8% of the 120 units are occupied by our consumers that receive direct services. And that's the way we want it. Canyon Shadows, like was mentioned at the Living Skills Center, is a real-life apartment environment where we do not feed folks. In a sense, those that live there must be responsible for paying their own utility bills, rent, food. When the 5 o'clock whistle blows Monday through Friday, so does our independent living skills instructors. They leave the premises and the consumer is on their own. So we do have an intensive intake process to make sure that when we make the decision so someone can move in and then benefit from our services, that they're ready for it. We don't always make that right decision. There's been times where we've accepted an individual into the program, and somewhere down the road, they need to be evicted. But they're not evicted because they're not properly learning the keyboard or using the two-touch technique during O&M training. They're evicted for breaking a rule or violating a rule as an individual would in an apartment environment. Too loud music, you know the things. And so sometimes we've had to do that. I would say in the last 6 years, it's happened twice. So it's not bad of a record. I will be direct with you in that Canyon Shadows, at its time, served, in our opinion, a great need in the Inland Empire. Not only for affordable housing, but for the services that we provide at Blindness Support Services. But what it lacked, in my opinion, was space. I mentioned it's a 120-unit apartment complex. It is. That's exactly what it is. And the rents are very, very low for the low to moderate income households. But they're small. You walk in the front door. There's a place for your kitchen table on your right. There's a small little kitchenette with a stove and dishwasher and sink. And there's a living space that you can barely fit a bed and a TV and maybe some little bits of furniture, and then there's those sliding door closets, and then a restroom. Very small. And so over the years, we had to disqualify. When I say we, our apartment management team, had to reject an applicant because of family size. In fact, I remember in 1998, just a couple years after we opened, BSS in Canyon Shadows was sued by Fair Housing because we disqualified a family, which included a blind person, to move in because they had three people in the household. And so we had to spend some time and effort to plead our case, which ultimately our side prevailed because we discovered that certain fire laws, fire regulations, had a minimum or a maximum of how many folks can live in a facility based on the square footage. So with that experience, I worked hard to figure out a way to develop another complex in our community that would have 2, 3, and perhaps maybe even 4 bedrooms. I focused on 2 or 3 bedrooms so that in the event in the future, people of low to moderate income needs that, of course, had a consumer who was visually impaired wanted to partake in our services and yet be able to live in a community that they can afford, let's figure out a way to do it. Well, we did. We figured out a way to do it. And with apologies to those of us who are like me and have very limited vision, I brought a couple of, I guess I would call them notebooks, with pictures. And this picture shows a brand new apartment complex, which will contain 110 units of 2, primarily 3, and 4 bedroom apartment units. On the grounds will have a comprehensive training facility that will be operated by BSS, about 2,500 square feet, where we will put computers and all the things that our folks need to become as independent as possible in their own home or apartment environment. The groundbreaking has already occurred. Okay, and the building should be completed by August. And so we will make sure the counselors in the field are invited to see the new facility. So we're looking forward to it. And again, it's just another approach that we're trying to do in this field of blind rehabilitation.
Okay.
Let's go back to the audience. And I know some of you may have questions. Yeah, you know what? Things are getting just a little long-winded, and I got to keep something in timing here. Okay, so looks like there's a question up in the front here. I think there's a person in the whitest shirt there. Sorry.
Hi. I came in on
It doesn't stretch.
No, he'll come to it.
Okay, great.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Eric Calhoun. I am from the Active Blind Inland Valley chapter. I came in on your discussion with regard to the services that you had for people who are blind and visually impaired with regard to the dorms. Now, I had some experience with that type of stuff, and with the Junior Blind Foundation when I was young. The question that I have for you is that if you could tell me a little bit about the dormitory configuration, what the difference is between the Junior Blind Foundation and your facility, it would be greatly appreciated.
You mean me, Mike, at OCB?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and maybe, Tricia, would you like me to go on and answer question number 2 about what it's like?
I've got to kind of try to keep things down just because I got to get the audience participating because it gets a little long-winded for them to keep listening to everybody.
I'll just answer the question then.
Okay.
Our dorm is a 2-story building. And it has, and the bedrooms, it is interesting that they're, all these places are a little bit different. At OCB, the dorm is a big concrete building built in the 60s. It would remind you, if you were there, of, a college that was built back then, just the way the facility seems, you know, the way the stairs are and the doors and all that. There's a big automatic door on the front. And then the configurations of the rooms, there's 2 rooms on, there's a room on either side of a bathroom. And so there's 2 people to a room. Each person has a desk, a nightstand, and the closet. And the closet's divided into two parts. One is where you hang your clothes, and the other has a dresser that's probably like 4.5 feet tall. One suite of rooms has been modified so that someone who used a wheelchair could get into the shower and so on, and have the proper distances in the toilet stall. So in that suite, we had to give up a sink in order to do that and widen the doors and kind of change the whole configuration a little bit. Also in the dorm, there's a TV room. There's a computer or study room up stairs and downstairs. There's two public bathrooms. There's a what we call a kitchen, but it's you know, a place with a microwave and a coffee pot and a toaster oven, refrigerator, and sink and all on the first and second floor. And our dorm counselor's office is in there too, and there's somebody on duty 24 hours a day. That's roughly the configuration.
Any more questions out there?
You did your.
This is Christy.
I have a question.
Okay, Christy, I'll go Christy, and then it will go to Elmer, and then there's another person in the back. Could you say your name?
David.
David. Then it goes to David. Okay, Christy.
No, that's okay. Peter, this question is for you. I think it's really awesome that you guys are doing what you're doing. And so I think for people to understand why you're doing what you're doing, my brother lived in one of those apartments, and I can tell you that it's a studio apartment with this teeny tiny bedroom. He's not kidding. Only one bed fit in there. And are you guys still having... Are you having one client live in there, or two, or are they living by themselves, or in the Canyon Shadows?
Thank you. I believe of the there's like 11 units being occupied by our clients right now, and I believe four have roommates, and there's three on their own. And yeah, thank you, Christy, because the living space is critical. I mean, picture living in a hotel room for 6 months or something. And but the concept, and let me just say this, because I think this is important. People move into our unit, they get involved in our program, and what we want to do, what our ultimate goal is make it so that they no longer qualify to live there, if you get my drift. What we want to do is get them work, get them employed, wherever that might be, and they make enough money, so then our apartment management says, you know what, you make too much money, and you don't qualify here anymore, and they move on. We've had some success with that over the years, because we would never want to turn it into a community where when people drive by, point to it and say, that's where all the blind people live. We don't want that to happen. We believe, and our philosophy is that a blind person, if they can afford it, should be able to live anywhere they want.
Okay, with the new facility, so with the new facility, the 1, 2, 3, and 4 bedroom or whatever it is, 2, 3, 4, yeah. Are you allowing, like, let's say, for instance, I had two teenage kids and my husband and me, and I wanted to be a part of the program. Would I be able to move my family into one of those and participate in your program?
Like Canyon Shadows, you and your family would have to qualify income-wise. In the Inland Empire, what we are planning to do with these brand new units, and there's no one bedroom, Christy. It's 2, 3, and 4. The one bedroom will be anywhere between $500 and $600 based on the family's income. The two bedroom will be between $600 and $700. I'm sorry, the three bedroom will be between $600 and $700, and the four bedroom will be between $700 and $800, and that's far below market rate. But the only way this type of program works is because you get investors to help build this project, which is $22 million. They get tax credits as property owners and it's very lucrative for them to do that. But in order to obtain those tax credits, they don't charge the market rate. a four-bedroom apartment complex in the Inland Empire might cost $1,600. But at, and this is going to be called Cypress Springs. I didn't mention that. Cypress Springs, it will be affordable. But, yeah, the only rule of thumb here, Christy, is you have to meet the income guidelines.
Okay, so, Elmer, you want to come on up? We have a short microphone here.
Okay.
Then you have to come all the way up here. Okay, go ahead.
I have a sort of a comparative question. If I correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, I think you've got an enrollment of about 15 and a staff of 31. Is that correct, right or wrong?
Well, it's a little more complex than that, but that's right at the moment.
Okay, so I will just go one by one on the rest of the panels. How does that compare to your ratio of student per staff? Ken?
In our classes, let me do it this way. O&M basically is one-on-one. In our other classes, it's no more than 6 or 7 to 1 person, and that's what we try. We try not to have more than 13 for 2 instructors, so that's why I'm saying between 6 and 7 to 1 would be our basic ratio. Peter?
We didn't answer that way.
Yeah. As far as our contract services in a particular month, anywhere between 45 and 55, that'll be unduplicated individuals served each month. And we have a staff of 13 and a part-time maintenance worker.
Oh, Patty. Sorry.
We have 18 students and 6 teachers and 4 administrators and a night supervisor, so a total of 11 staff and 18 students.
Thank you. Now, once more, this question applies to the panel in general. We'll start out with, well, Mike, or we'll just go down the line as we did the first time around. How many of you panelists have an employment component or a job outcome?
We're going to be hitting that on the next question.
Okay.
Yes, we're going to go there.
Okay, withdraw the question.
Okay. We're going to get to it, definitely.
I'd like to answer you a little bit more completely, Elmer, if that's okay with you, Tricia.
Sure.
I mean, we sound like we have this millions of employees and no students. All the programs, as you've heard, differ as to how much staffing they require. I mean, if you don't, at OCB, we have, it's kind of interesting. I just love to tell people this. The Department of Rehab has over 2,000 employees, and we're the only place. OCB is the only place that has teachers, the only place that has a nurse, we are the only maintenance folks, the only kitchen crew, in the entire Department of Rehab. So in order to run a facility 7 days a week, yeah, we have somebody there awake and aware 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that includes kitchen crew and stuff like that. Shall we? Do you want us to do the program? Oh, somebody else, David, wanted a question.
Christy, you took that question right away because I wanted to ask that specific question. But I do have another one for Peter. Who are the investors that you are trying to get to come on board to help facilitate the growth of your new facility?
Well, actually, thank you for the question. I'm not trying anymore because we already have them. Canyon Shadows, we became its managing general partner in December of 1998 through some home funds through the federal government and some local CDBG funds. And again, when we became managing general partner, one of our roles was to, first of all, acquire the property, which was pretty much in rundown shape. Use some of the funds to rehab it, plant trees, put in security, plant grass, fix windows, install refrigerators and air conditioning systems. As far as Cypress Springs, which, you know, barring any unforeseen weather conditions or, knock on wood, no earthquakes, we're looking at beginning to move in folks in July or August of this year with a major celebration happening in September. But as far as us, to back to your question, looking for investors, that's been done already. This Cypress Springs has been 3 years in the works. Last year, we had the initial groundbreaking ceremony where the mayor came out and basically took a shovel and, you know how they do, all ceremonial type of things. And so, but we're looking forward to the grand opening with speeches, of course, and food and refreshments and tours. I do may want to add, last year in May, we were able to secure Anthony Candela, who was part of the speakers bureau when we had the groundbreaking a year ago.
Great. Okay. So I know one thing that the rehab committee had brought up when we were putting this together is that they were concerned that many counselors had come to the rehab committee and had stated that they were having trouble getting into some centers. Some were much easier to get into, and others were much more so many steps that you couldn't even enter into the center. And I just want to know if some of the panelists here will work with us on trying to make an easier entry into the centers for people.
Trish?
Yes. Go ahead.
Maybe to answer that a little bit. Basically, the only people we really won't accept, and as I say basically, I mean, there are always going to be some differences here, but we don't have an ESL program, so therefore we need to have someone who can speak enough English to go through the program, because if they can't speak English, then Braille and computers will be out, especially with literacy. O&M, we have one person that does speak Spanish, but one person is very difficult, you know, even though that maybe all of the Spanish-speaking folks would go to that person. When it comes to independent living services, skills, we do have our ILS person can speak Spanish, but because of the fact that we have English and Spanish speaking people in the class, we again try and really keep it to speaking English. And so, you know, then we get to the point, as I said, sixth grade literacy. We get to the point of people who are in wheelchairs. If we have had people in wheelchairs that have partial vision, and we feel it's very important that someone in a wheelchair have partial vision, only because it would be hard to teach them O&M or have them push themselves or get around from point A to point B and use a cane at the same time to make sure that of where they're at. We're just not equipped to do it. The other thing is, if people are not self-medicating, we also will not take them. The only area where they do not have to be self-medicating when they come to us would be for diabetes purposes. We do have a nurse on staff from roughly 6:30 a.m. until 10 p.m. And so we do have people during the day. What we also like to do is work with the Center for the Partially Sighted to come over and train people, because one of the things that happens, we get clients who do not come with talking glucometers, do not come with counted doses, do not come with any kind of accessible diabetic equipment to take care of themselves. And personally, I think that's one thing that if they don't have with their insurance and can't get it right away, that ought to be one of the first things that I think the counselor needs to get the person is taken care of, so that they can regiment their own diabetic needs, especially today with the cost of some of these things being $75 now instead of $500. But those are the exceptions. And so, as I said, basically, if they don't speak enough English for literacy, if they're not self-medicating, and of course, you know, they also we have to look at their, as I said, if there's a prison record, something like that would interfere with our kids on campus and stuff, we will usually give everybody else a real chance as long as we feel that they really have sincerity in completing the program.
Okay, you're off the hook. Okay.
I don't know. It may seem as though, I mean, sometimes there are anecdotal situations where somebody says, oh, gosh, you guys are sure playing hard to get. But I.
I think Mike, we should say that we have had counselors have been feel like it's been really tough to get people accepted at OCB, and we'd really love to work with you on trying to make that process easier.
Yeah.
If you would agree to do that with us.
Well, we're always. I mean, we're nowhere without customers. So
okay.
We're certainly happy to work with you. And
when could we meet to do this?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, if we were talking about specific situations, that I think we would work with the individual counselors on their situations, unless you know of some systemic
problem. We have some issues, yeah. So we would really love to do that with you. I'm sure it'd be a very simplistic process, but if we just sit down and work on it.
Well, one thing that we are going to do is, you know, we're right in the thick of all the counselor trainings and stuff like that. I don't think we're hard to reach. And if anybody has a specific process problem,
you need the time and we'll be there. How about that?
Okay.
I mean, we really do want to work with you on this, okay. and we want to make it simple.
Well, I think if you want to call us up, we'll try to find a way to work out any problems. We're partners with our counselors. In fact, we know that you guys are really our customers because you're the ones who make the referrals. So,
Madam Chair, I'd like to identify a couple of problems, if I may, or at least inquire. Do you still require psychologicals, Mike?
No. Well, I don't know what you mean by that, Elmer.
Let me put another. Do you still require otologicals?
We would like to know, especially if somebody has a hearing loss, we would like to know about that. And we'd also like, especially what with the boomers, that if there are mitigating things like hearing aids that would benefit somebody when they were there, we would sure like to know that process was well underway. And that's come about because we've had people come, and the process with rehab is so darn slow getting people audiological equipment that sometimes the person has been there 6 months without the stuff, and we could do so much more if they had it, that we have become sort of proactive trying to work on that. But let me say along those lines, we don't just complain. We try to bring the parties together. We were one who actually worked to make relationships with one of the hearing society groups that can do some assessments and help the process along. We didn't just sit back and say, this is not viable. We said, let's talk to these people and see if we can work something out. I think you'll find, in general, that's our approach.
Well, we appreciate if you will work with us on it, because we really would like to. We started off talking about how this group is about social change and making things better for the rehab consumer. And if you would work with us on that, we would be grateful. And we're here on Saturday. I know you said you have to leave today, but Saturday we're here. Could you make a time? We'd be happy to meet.
It won't be Saturday, but
okay.
But anyway, we'll get together.
Well, I'd really like to set up a time, because I think that is key to us making this important change. Is there a time next week we could address some of that?
You know, Tricia, we're always available. If you want to call with a proposal for getting together about it, and you have something specific in mind, we're all for that. I do have to say though, every application, every client is different. So, I mean,
and we understand, and we want to hear you out fully too, but we want to make sure that we work together and put a different format together. We found it very difficult lately to get consumers into the center, and we'd really like to work with you to set the tone with that, and if you would agree to do that with us.
I'm certainly open to discussing it.
Okay, great. Then I'll be in contact with you and maybe just leave you a message about a time that we could start then to do that, because we really have to do it. Okay. Okay. All right. I think let's skip the second question, which was, what do people do at the centers? In each center, I'm just gonna take for that each center people go and learn Braille. They learn how to do mobility lessons. They learn how to do adaptive cooking. They learn how to work with computers, adapted computers. And maybe there's something I'm missing here. And I know Patty has always wanted to do more of a vocational component, and we'd love to help you in any center that wants to put more emphasis on a vocational components in their centers, where our rehab committee is specifically very interested in that. Let's go to the next question, which is basically, what does each center do for employment?
Start with me. Okay, we have, let me say first and foremost that OCB is not a place where you go to learn a skill that you will immediately turn into a job skill. We see our role as pre-vocational. We see our role as helping people get a grip on new vision loss. Now, that isn't to say that everybody who comes to us is new to vision loss, but a lot of people are. And we want to help people learn attitudes of independence right along with the skills that they need, the adaptations and the modified skills. We have a pretty full plate. That said, we have tried some things that I think have been very successful. Last year we did a job club with brought in a lot of people and pitched it to people who were really saying that they had every intention of returning to work. And that was pretty good, and we may try that again. But in the meantime, what we do is one of our teachers works on trying to talk with people on career things and hooking them up with mentors. We also do a fact sheet, or kind of a, oh, I guess you could say a resume thing, so that people can readily retrieve the information about themselves. We try to explore their interests. And, of course, we have lots of discussions. And the skills that we teach, we hope, will stand people in good stead to move back to their counselor and pursue their plan for employment. I mean, we believe that we were set up with the goal of helping people deal with an aspect of their adjustment, and we think we do a good job of that. But we don't have a specific job skill that you walk out of OCB with, you know, like you would have if you went and learned transcription work or something like that. You don't go to OCB and spend 40 hours a week on a specific job skill. You want to?
Sure.
Thank you. At the Davidson program, we have a few things. One, we don't really go and teach someone enough to actually go directly into a job most of the time. However, I can say since I've been there, and it's just over 5 years now, we had one person who left and went back to her job as a school counselor. I even attended 3 different meetings with the school district because they were not going to let her back, and she ended up going back to work. So I was very pleased about that. I think it helped being a rehab counselor in that case, having been one. So normally, though, we do teach resume writing. We do teach time management, dress for success. We talk about the various things that people are going to need. We're more into the situation of training people so that those who would like to work are prepared to go and get the remainder of the training they might need for the employment goal that they want to reach. We have had probably in the neighborhood of 7 or 8 people going into BEP directly from DPI, and that's because they did learn the computer skills that were necessary. We do go as far as teaching them Microsoft Word, other than the adaptive stuff. I mean, I think that's going to be obvious to you guys, but we do Microsoft Word. We do enough Excel to be able to balance a checkbook. We teach some of the other things. We even had a couple of people who were total who learned PowerPoint. And we have some excellent computer folks working with us right now. We're very fortunate to have a great computer staff. In our Microsoft Word, some of the lesson plans even include things like just doing wanted posters and all kinds. And they do it basically so that they can learn the different aspects of what Microsoft Word can do. And at least that way they have a real feeling for the program. If they did go out and wanted to be a receptionist or something, when they leave our program, they would certainly have enough of those skills. Towards the last 4 to 6 weeks of their program at DPI, our average, by the way, right now of getting someone in and sending them home is 5 months. Now, we've had somebody there for 3 and 4 months who've picked up their skills, a couple who've been 6, 7, 8 months. But the average right now is 5 months. And within that time, we have actually the last 4 to 6 weeks, we've had people going into a couple of internships, whether it's doing some computer research with the internet to help find funding sources. And then, you know, they work with the development department in the administration building. We've had a couple of folks who've worked in the reception area, learning how to answer the phones and connecting people properly, how to have proper telephone techniques. Again, a lot of it just depends on what types of jobs the individuals would like to have. When it's necessary, we will also try and do some assessment testing. I hate to say testing. It is just an assessment. There's self-directed search that we've used. We're trying to look for something really a lot better than that now. But at times, we still have to use it. And it gives folks at least some type of a goal to go towards. Most of the people who are newly blinded come into us not even thinking they could ever work again. So, you know, we had another person who worked for a big candy company, and I won't go into the name of it. But when he got out, at least he was able to go to them and try to apply for a job as a dispatcher for the trucking outfit, because he used to drive the truck. He knew the routes and knew the area. So, and he had the computer skills to be able to keep up with those routes. And we're very proud of doing those things. So we really aim more towards pre-employment, but we do have a couple of folks who do get employed.
Okay, this is Patty from the Living Skills Center again. Like Mike and Ken were saying, our whole emphasis is on transition. We're a little different in that probably 90% of our participants are congenitally visually impaired, usually fresh out of high school. Although we have no upper age limit, we have people who are older. But most of our students have never had a first job. So there's a whole different mindset to that. And a lot of times they just want to sit in a room and try to think of a job. So we're trying to get them out of that thought pattern and, you know, get them to know how other people get jobs. So, you know, everything that we do is geared toward employment, just as Mike and Ken were saying, being on time and all of that stuff that Tricia named, so I won't go through all of it. Once our students have gotten their feet on the ground a little bit about feeding themselves and traveling in the community, we start a pre-vocational evaluation, and we work on pre-vocational skills, writing resumes, interviewing skills, and so on. We also run group classes about vocational curriculum. We have guest speakers who are visually impaired come to talk to our students, and, you know, we want people to know that people who are visually impaired are employed and have great jobs. We had Tim Ford come recently, and I think a lot of you know him. He's a blind attorney. He's on our board, and he was our first vocational teacher. We currently don't have a vocational teacher. We lost our funding for that. Jim Gibbons is coming from the National Industries for the Blind. We just have guest speakers come in. We've also attended vocationally related workshops in the community at the Center for Independent Living. Tricia did one of those. We try to get all of our students signed up for Career Connect to learn how to use that system to look at different careers and jobs that people who are visually impaired have had. We also refer them to the Transition to Employment website. We're very active on that website and trying to give people resources for employment. We have everybody sign up for Newsline so that they are current with news, so that they are competitive with their sighted peers. And if it's appropriate, we will try to get them a volunteer job. Now, the reason why we're able to be a little flexible about this is we're set up differently. It's totally individualized curriculum. They don't go to school at the Living Skills Center day out, every single day. Some days they don't even have classes. And so our students are able to attend school and work while they're at the Living Skills Center. All of our students, all of our teachers, the Living Skills teachers and the mobility teachers, are also financial advisors. They're the ones that are working on vocational needs with our students. And because of our flexible schedule and the financial advisors are there, that if they're able to pay their bills and do everything, then the financial advisor can sort of take on the role of a vocational teacher. They squeeze it in, believe me. Our teachers are really dedicated. So I just want to go over briefly what our current students are doing so you have an idea. One of our students is volunteering to work for us as a Braille instructor 2 to 3 days a week, a supplemental to our other Braille instructor, and she's going to volunteer in a VI classroom one day a week because her career goal is to be a teacher for the visually impaired. Another student is volunteering in a VI classroom one day a week, and she's taking classes at Contra Costa College. Her career goal is as an O&M teacher. We have one student interning at the Lighthouse. We like to collaborate with the Lighthouse when we can, and she is working in the Lighthouse store, the adaptation store. And that's her first job experience. She also plans to job shadow a court reporter, and her career goal is to be a court reporter. She's actually taken classes in that. We have a student taking a class at Contra Costa College. He volunteers tutoring at Helms Junior High School, and he recently obtained a part-time job as the adult recreation coordinator at the Lighthouse. So he's doing all that while he's at our center. And we had one student taking ESL classes. So although we work with the Lighthouse to try to get people job experience, it's not always feasible for us because of restrictions that they have to have because of their funding. For age requirements, they can't be over the age of 21. We have students over the age of 21 who have never had a job. That's really important, I think, for rehab to start recognizing that we can't put age limitations on people who've never worked. They need the same experiences that maybe an 18-year-old needs if they've never had a job. And also the time requirements that the Lighthouse has, and travel requirements. And they're wonderful. The Lighthouse is wonderful. They're working with us. We really appreciate it. But we'd like to develop some more things. We're really actively working toward developing things. Things we've had people do in the past, very briefly, they can go to a trade school while they're at our place. Street Tech is one, National Holistic for Massage Therapy. And we've had people get jobs at Costco and different things. We've also worked to try to get people jobs as interpreters, which is a very viable job for people who are visually impaired. We are always looking for new ideas and opportunities. So if any of you out there, I've been talking to Tricia a lot about this. She's got great ideas. We don't have the staff to take on a lot, but we will do whatever we can to move people forward that it's appropriate for. And it's not necessarily appropriate for all of our folks to be doing this at this point in their life until they have more skills.
You were going to say something, someone?
Tony? I just want to commend Patty for what she's...
I was going to say the same thing. I was going to, whoa.
I also wanted to just mention, too, one of the things I think that rehab could be real helpful with, just like at Richard's program at CSB, they have a work experience program. Mm-hmm. And I think that the students at the Skill Center would be an ideal group.
We have to get the funding, Tony. That's what we
can. No. Rehab pays for it. Rehab pays. We put all the money through the Skill Center, and rehab basically pays the work experience costs.
We were told that
that's
somehow.
Well, then that means that CSB's been double dipping for 15 years.
Good job.
This is really important. This is the important things to come out today. This is very key because this is just the path that we'd really like to see the centers move in, and I do commend Patty just because it's they have no vocational counselor there.
If there's some way we can work together on doing that, I think you're
exactly
the flexibility of the program. I think that would be an ideal.
Yeah. Wonderful,
absolutely
wonderful.
We'd love it.
I know Mike had stated that he had to leave at 3:00. Is that Is that right, Mike?
Yes.
It's there, yeah. And so we just, I know I'm going to have Peter speak in a minute, but, thank you very much for coming today, Mike. And I do hope you want to work with us on everything and improve some issues that could make a better world for the blind consumers. And then Peter?
Thank you, Patricia. I mentioned earlier that BSS began its partnership with the department in July of 1998. And I think it's important that we think about the word partnership, because us folks on this side of the table are partners of the department. Well, now BFS, Blind Field Services, there's certain things that we can do that you can't. And there's meaning the department. And there's certain things that the department can do that we can't. An example of that would be the procurement of equipment. In 1998, our case service contract included two full-time career specialists / job developers. Actually, we had a career specialist and then we had a job developer. The initial idea was to have the career specialist do all the job prep work. Like Ken was saying, the how to interview, the dress for success type of things, the resume preparation and the cover letter writing and how to fill out an application, job application, as clean and as concise as possible. And then we had a job developer who went out in the world and pounded the pavement and talked to potential employers as to giving a consumer an opportunity to compete for a job in the real world. And that was tough. I mean, and it is tough. For those of you that are counselors within the system, placing blind and visually impaired people is the toughest thing that I know I can say for BSS. It's the toughest thing we do. When it comes to teaching folks to use the proper use of the white cane, success rate is over 90%. When we train folks in the activities of daily living, over 80% success rate. When we work with our parents in a program that's funded through another source, our success rate is tremendously high. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you that under our case service contract, everybody that comes through our doors is going to get placed. No, it's not going to happen. We're lucky. In fact, this year is probably one of our better years, and we're at 45% success rate as far as the number of consumers that we put through the program in a year's time. And usually that's anywhere between 20 and 22 for our employment preparation, job development, and placement component of our program. And it's tough for a lot of reasons. You know, the barriers that our folks encounter in getting jobs, whether it's the discrimination that people that we face, whether it's our own abilities or lack thereof, whether it's our own educational experience, which may just include high school, as Patty was describing. And yet, under contract with the department, with our partner, we're asked to place folks. And I've learned over the years that it's difficult to compare folks, not only such as BSS, but those of us that are involved in the placement side of things, and even you counselors. As a member of the Blind Advisory Committee, I'm privy to a lot of information, including, I just received from Joe Smith from the department, a list of successful closures and who placed what. Why is one counselor in the department placing 15 blind and visually impaired consumers in a year and another counselor zero? I kind of analyze it to a card player. Everybody's playing Texas Hold'em these days. And if you get a good hand, chances are you're going to win. But there are some of us that receive, maybe a client is not ready. We try to work with a job-ready consumer, and we defined it as how we saw what that meant. you know, a person that's able to take care of themselves from a self-grooming standpoint, a person that can travel to and from point A through Z on their own independently in the event they do get a job, and then a person who at least meets the minimum qualifications of a particular job opening, and then the ability to perform the essential functions of the job. That's a job-ready consumer. And in my experience, and this is not a knock on counselors, because you guys have caseloads of maybe 100 to 150. Wow. I mean, talk about overload. How can that individual counselor get to know whether or not that consumer is job-ready? So what happens, they refer them to an organization such as BSS, who has a ready built-in case service contract with qualified personnel to do the job. And then we discover somewhere down the road, you know what, this person's not exactly job-ready, and we try to refer them to further education. We're like Mike, too. We do not have a system where we're going to train somebody to be a carpenter or a dentist. We're not a vocational school. We do, however, work very hard in trying to convince an employer to give a consumer a chance, an opportunity to compete. And that's what we focus on. And we're getting better and better at it every year. The other thing that BSS does in the area of employment is we hire blind and visually impaired people. I'm proud to say that I like to talk in percentages, so please bear with me. But I believe 48% of our employees are either blind or visually impaired, and about 52 or 53 have bilingual capabilities. So that's it.
Okay, so we're going to open it up to questions on the floor here. And Priscilla Ching did come from the Society for the Blind, and I did want her to speak in the end just briefly about her center, just so that everybody does have some idea about what they're doing over at Society for the Blind. But first, Christy wanted to ask a question here. She's starting on the floor here.
Okay, this is a question for everybody to consider. When I was a vocational rehabilitation counselor, my first year I placed 21 people, and they were some very good jobs. And Peter's right. Boy, it's the hand you're dealt. And not only that, but, you know, different people have different problems that come up, etc. I had a very promising young woman who I hope is hopefully here at the convention, because I hope I get to see her. But, you know, a lot of health issues happen and things happen. And so the next year I placed 4 people. And I got in big, deep doo-doo from my supervisor. And that was not a fun thing. But one of the things that I found is that there's a lot that voc rehab cannot do. And you need another service to step in, and that is vocational readiness counseling. Be it from a coach, a social worker. Frankly, that would be, if I could do the job that I would love of my life, the state could hire me and I can go up and down the state and work with folks to really get them ready to get out there and go do it. Because so many folks are not getting hired, not because they don't know their stuff, not because they're smart, but they don't get it. I have somebody who I've worked with who's a bright person, but the person just doesn't have the job savvy. And it's just, you know, it's kind of frustrating, because that makes a bad name for when we do get hired. There's a big gap, and I don't know how we're going to fill it, but we've got to do something, because it's not going away.
Christy? If I can answer a little bit, how can I say this? I'm one of the people Christy plays, so in a new career. And actually, I enjoyed working with her. She wouldn't put up with any garbage from anybody, and I think that's important. I think there are lots of people, actually, you'd be amazed, and probably more so with the congenitally blind, who have been brought up in our time today, and maybe it's getting off the subject. I like to hope it isn't, because I think this is where rehab needs to work, where we all need to work together. Obviously, we know the education system has changed over the years. You'd be amazed how many people we get who are 21, who can't spell, who can't read, who can't write, and it's absolutely incredible. I've had people come in even at the age of 20, 25, saying, well, what kind of blind jobs are there? And I'll tell them, Venetian blinds, leveler blinds. I mean, what else can you say to somebody? Because if they have no concept, hopefully the new transition programs that Richard's involved with, that we're involved with our STEP program also in Southern Cal Junior Blind, hopefully these things will try and pick up some of those areas. But, you know, a lot of it starts at home, you guys. And if we can't get to the families of these people, we're not going to place anybody. And it's amazing. I had one person came in, she was 60, and I told her finally after a few weeks, I said, you have no social skills. She said, well, I thought you guys were going to teach us that. I said, if you don't know it by 60, you can leave. and it's true. You can't. It's a sad thing to say, but there are so many folks out there that don't know how to shake hands with someone when they go on an interview. They don't know how to dress. They don't know how to even handle an interview. And it's, I just want to tell you a little bit. And you can't talk to a person that way. That first impression of the first 30 seconds is it. And if you don't get past that first 30 seconds, you're not going to get the job. I don't care how well you do afterwards. But the thing is, what we need to do, even with rehab's help now, is work harder, I think, in the transition programs with the younger students who are coming up, maybe lower the age from 16 and try and do some transition stuff in the school districts, try and do a combination between school and rehab so that there are projects for these kids to do so that they can go to a summer part-time job and get hired and maybe even get fired like sighted kids do to be able to understand exactly what it means to work when they get when they grow up and become 18, 19, 20.
I do have to go. I'm the caregiver at home right now because my wife has had her second hip replacement and she's not quite up and about just yet, so I have to catch the train and go. And I want to say that I appreciate being with you guys as always, and thank you very much for inviting us. And I'm very proud to say that one of the things we do is try to get our students involved in consumer organizations, and toward that end, I think throughout this weekend you'll see probably a dozen of our students and some staff, and we're really happy that we can help people discover consumer organizations, because one of the things I believe is that people will begin to see themselves as people who work when they get around other blind folks. If you're the only one, it's really hard to know. All you hear is all this stuff from your family that's well-intentioned, but not necessarily all about how okay you are. It tends to be about how not okay you are. And so being around, we all know, being around each other really helps. And so that's something that I think we do, that we're proud of, and we've been able to help for people who want to stay over and be part of conventions. We can actually help defray some of that cost. So there's a whole lot that we do at all our programs that we didn't get to today, the details of how we do it. I think a lot of you do know our programs pretty well, and so I'm glad that we had a chance to be together and thank you again for inviting us. We want to do the best we can.
And thank you so much for informing consumers about getting involved. That's great. We really, really appreciate that. Does anybody else have any questions for the panel here about employment, or should we open it up for Priscilla to talk a little? You want to say something?
My name is Robert Wint, and I work as a career counselor. And I would say I probably have 8 students on the campus now that have some type of visual impairment. All of them are clients of the department. And one of the problems I'm beginning to see is that there isn't always facilitation for the students to have adaptive equipment for internships. And it's an issue that's really starting to rear its ugly head, because I have students that are ready, but the counselor wants to see that the student can do it, and so we've got this catch-22 happening. And to that end, one of the things we're trying to do is use our workability counselor and start students early and find them things on the campus to do, and then use those skills as a jumping-off point, and then hopefully using that as support to the Department of Rehab counselor. But I think using the workability programs or a model like that may answer Christy's, you know, suggestion, is finding another model that can be used in other than the educational settings.
I think if it becomes an issue, I think that you should talk to the supervisor of the counselor, or, you know, just really have to set up a meeting, because you're right. I mean, for a lot of these jobs, I mean, even for basic jobs, there might need to be some scripting involved. I mean, it's just not that easy. There might be a lot of upfront work that needs to get done. So I think that that's the one good thing that's come out of having BFS, is that we do seem to get equipment to people a lot quicker than we did when we were in the districts. And I think the scenario that you just mentioned is a perfect scenario where equipment is essential for somebody, and we're talking about the first job, and if they don't have the equipment, they're not going to be able to do the first job. So I would really just encourage you to encourage the consumer to set up a meeting and go through whatever appeals process is necessary to be able to do it, because delivering mail on campus to people is just not going to really expand them that much.
You know, call our rehab committee. They can always contact me.
That's right. Yeah, tell them to call Tricia Leach. She'll set up a meeting for sure.
That's what we do, though. And this is, does anybody else have anything? Priscilla's going to speak just real brief here.
I am so sorry for coming in late. I was filling in for Michelle Bruns. Basically, the Society for the Blind, the program that I work with, is called the Senior Impact Project, and we serve clients who are 55 and older in a residential component where they come for 6 days to the senior intensive retreat, and they learn skills and daily living skills and Braille and technology. They learn about orientation mobility and have some good discussions. We are actually going to be speaking on Saturday at 9 o'clock at the Senior Division with Bonnie Rennie. So if you're interested in learning more about that, we welcome you to join us. And primarily we serve the population of 55 and older, so blind or low vision, and we have a very easy intake process, and usually we can fit them in the next month for our retreats. And if they're also open to getting in-home training, let's say they have other health concerns, we can also serve them in their homes. We serve the Sacramento region, the Chico region, and the Mount Diablo region.
Okay. I really want to thank everybody for coming, and it is all the people that do come that give us the strength to make the changes we do for people. I really want to thank the panelists so much today. Ken, thank you very much for coming and speaking and being such a important part of this discussion. And also, Peter, thank you for coming and being an important part of this panel today. And Patty, thank you very much also. And I have to say, you look pretty glowing there on that employment stuff. So I can honestly say you're doing a lot at your center for that.
Okay. Thank you. Come here,
Charles. Right now, you guys, we were going to go over resolutions, and Elmer was going to talk about the history of some of the resolutions historically, and he's got some... He's not long-winded. He's going to be exciting, I promise. Where the heck are you going? And then we're just going to talk about maybe some current resolutions that we may want to do.
They had tickets. Yeah, I get it.
Okay, here we go, guys.
I didn't hear. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question for you, Peter, and Ed and I were talking about historically.
Yeah.
Who are the last few directors of rehab? We got back as far as about 1992, 1993, something like that. We can't figure out who was before.
Who was before Bill Tater? My memory's a little fuzzy.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. No, I'll check that out, but I don't remember that. But I want to hearken back to why we have an organization. I think Trish, did you say that? What about 70? What percentage of blind people are unemployed?
What
percentage of blind people are unemployed?
72%.
Well, you see, 72% is a pretty good chunk. And that says something about, the condition that the prevailing conditions in society that tend to marginalize blind people. And I'm sort of a mustache Pete in this outfit. I started out with Dr. Perry, one of the founders of the California Council, Dr. Tenbrook, one of the founders of the NFB. And I think it was Montaigne who said, that the more things change, the more they remain the same. And they're certainly, all of you out there in the field certainly know that there are many conditions that marginalize blind people. And to the extent that we can, to the extent that we can reduce or ameliorate the conditions that marginalize blind people, that's the goal of our job. That's what we're in business for. And it just goes a way back. When back in the 60s, when they're having this war on poverty, why these people from the ghettos will say, why we have the three B's of the ghettos: barbecues, beauty shops, and bars. And I said, we're way ahead of you. We had our three B's before you guys ever thought of them: brooms, baskets, and brushes. Well, blind people no longer make brooms, baskets, and brushes, fortunately. So I think we're less marginalized to that extent. But the power of, the power of organization, let me speak to the power of organization, and I'm sorry Mike isn't here to hear this, but I don't think he'd want to hear it anyway. There have been three attempts to close OCB, and the last of which was by the late unlimited Bill Tater. And California Council of the Blind put up $75,000 worth of sound bites. And I'll say that again, $75,000 worth of sound bites. That ain't hay, folks. That tells you about the power of organization. But I'm also frank to tell you that support has evaporated. And those are the kind of conditions that we must address as well. And I think probably the most salient resolution that in recent was, of course, SB 105, which created the separate division for rehab. But the list goes on and on, and I wouldn't I wouldn't presume to try and encapsulate all those, but I'm just telling you that organization counts, and we're a very living example of organization that counts. And as long as I've been in the business, I just feel very, very honored and flattered to be working with you. And also, there's another thing that we, as agency personnel, need to deal with. We have so many more multiply handicapped blind people. The blind population has changed, and that presents a very tough issue vocationally. And since somebody once alluded to somebody who didn't like guide dog, you know, I don't qualify because as a dog lover and a dog owner, I can't resist it. It seemed this guy was out. His dog seemed very listless, and he took him to the vet, laid him on the table, and the vet said, "Why, that dog's dead." He said, "God, he can't be. You know, I was playing with him this morning." So the vet said, "Well, let me check this out." So he put a cat on the table, and the dog didn't move a muscle. He said, "See, I told you that dog's dead." He said, "Now that'll be $1,400. $1,400? How'd we arrive at that?" "Well, that's what we typically charge for a cat skin." I'm going to let you go on that one. Thank you.
You are done now. Well, Elmer's a good guy. And I want to, you know, make a statement about OCB. Is one thing I hear that is always great about OCB is the teachers. That is one thing my consumers consistently say are really good. And if are they still in the room, you guys? Oh, good. I'm glad. Okay. We do hear that consistently, and we just want to make sure that you know that we're there for you, okay? Does anybody else want to bring up some resolutions that they might want to do at this current convention? I brought up earlier we want to write a thank you resolution to HumanWare, and in it I think we're alluding a little bit that, you know, Freedom Scientific has not come to the table to work with us, and I don't know how far we want to take that. We just want to let them go and work with companies that want to work with us, or if we want to say more. But, you know, I know there's talk of people wanting me to beef that up. So, but the great thing is we are going to be in the resolution room. It's going to start in the morning at 8 o'clock, and then I think we'll meet tomorrow night again around 10. And it's always a great part of the convention. I don't know. Does anybody have any that they're?
I have.
Okay, one. Okay.
This is Ed Crespin. I don't have a resolution, but I've been sitting here having thoughts about how to tackle some of the stuff that's happened with the counselor teacher program, and also from us who work and are continuing to work, but then have to improve our skills because our vision changes or our job situation changes. It's very difficult to, you know, apply for services through the Department of Voc Rehab if you're working 40 hours a week. But there has to be some kind of mechanism, maybe for, now this would only work for people who are on SSI, SSDI, but possibly a mechanism where they could use their Medi-Cal, Medicare to tap into the four centers and maybe get some of that training, and then maybe work out something for insurance companies where you can get some of this other training, because things change too fast. I remember when we first got our first computer was what, DOS oriented,
yeah.
And the biggest computer system that you could get was a 512 megabytes, and back then, of course, it was WordPerfect. Now the software has really changed, but there's a lot of people out there who are working but don't have any access to the changes and learning the new changes. Yes, you can get the JAWS for Windows upgrade, the Open Book upgrade, and things like that, but the Windows, we don't have any kind of training like that to help. So I was wondering if maybe that could be something for the future to look at.
Okay. You want to say something, Christy?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm really serious.
Come on. It's so short, so you gotta
keep
going there.
I just killed you.
Well, I'm really serious about what I said, and I really think that whether it's me or somebody else, I think we need people to be able to counsel and educate our consumers, so that they can gain the life skills that they need to be able to be successful in employment. So whether it's whether we're going to ask for some positions, like maybe one per district? Or, I'm sorry, because you're one district, one per region, like, you know, north, central, south kind of thing, where we have somebody who is a social worker. And, yeah, I'm shamelessly pushing social workers. Also, to have, you know, I use job coaches on some of my folks that were harder to place and had a harder time keeping a job. One of the things that I found is that if you have a job coach who learns kind of the ropes and can teach the individual who just got employed how to do the stuff, it goes over a lot better than having coworkers who really don't know you. The first thing that they do is find out how much help you need, and they start running the other way when you start coming. And I've experienced that. And I've seen other people, I've seen it happen to other people. So I think we, here I am talking like a rehab counselor. Hear that, Lilia? I want to be a rehab counselor. I'm concerned that we're not utilizing, you're not utilizing as rehab counselors the job coaches. And maybe there need to be some job coaches employed by the Department of Rehabilitation who can go out and work with the employers so that the newly employed consumer can, you know, have full access and become an equal partner at the workplace rather than the person who needs help.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh. You want to say something? Okay, this is good. I like this. Everybody has a voice.
Hi, I'm Linda Porrell, and I'd like to respond to what Christy's been saying. First of all, social workers rule, of course. But anyway, I just got a position at San Francisco Vocational Services as visual impairment placement specialist. I've been there a few months, but I've had over 20 years' experience in social work in the blindness field. And I am seeing a lot of this sort of psychological unreadiness for work. The rehab folks will send us a client, and they're trying very hard to send people who they think are job-ready. And yet there's a great deal of unreadiness in their minds about the whole world of work. What I want to put forward is that I've been looking around, and I've found a couple of websites that I think are really terrific and empowering with lots of good articles about these issues. One is esite.org, and the esite, E-S-I-G-H-T, .org, and the other one is diversityworld.com, and they're just, I'm learning a lot just that I want to incorporate in my work just looking at those. So thanks.
Any more comments or somebody want
to? Okay. Job coaches, if I may.
Sure. And then Ed wants to say something.
Why, there was an incident in San Jose where the job coach took this blind person who was totally dependent. He had no blind skills. So she took him to the employer, and the employer said, well, you know, I can't hire that guy because he can't take care of himself. Now, you see, not only did she blow that interview, but you see, what's he going to say the next blind guy he comes on across? And so that's where we have to be very discriminating about the kind of job coaches we employ. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. And Ed?
Well, there's one area that OCB, all four of these centers that we have, I'd like to see that there is a implementation of a social worker at the Orientation Center for the Blind, and the Department of Rehab really should really encourage that as part of the component of vocational training, because a lot of times we're dealing with people who come into the door, get the application, they want a job, but they really haven't gotten their personal life together, let alone their blindness. And that should be part of the component. Now, yes, we are supposed to be adjustment counselors in a sense, but we are not therapists, and we can't do that. Our focus is vocational placement. And having a social worker in one of the centers and funded by the Department of Rehab would really help that, because there are so many issues that people have internally that it's blocking them from really finding the employment. I mean, God, I could do dozens and dozens of examples of that happening. And I think Ken is coming up my way. No? Okay, but that's my idea.
Okay, I think we do need to make room for that. Okay, here.
Here you go, Ken.
Thanks.
It's kind of come in kind of close because it's so short.
Oh, there we go. I can almost still do that. You know, I think one of the interesting things is we look at the 78-22 percentages, 78 unemployed, 22 employed. Of the 78 that are unemployed, I think 78%, I think we'd almost have to look at it and say, if you were the employer, let's say the rehab counselors or the folks that are in the various rehab programs, how many of those people today would you hire? And I don't know the reason. I mean, you know, we can all conjecture. We spoke earlier about the educational system changing and everything else. What are we as a consumer group not doing to teach these folks, to mentor these folks, to get them involved, to get their families involved when they're little? We're missing something somewhere by not being involved with the young kids that are blind. We're not getting involved enough by not being involved with the families of blind children. And so, as far as I can see, the congenitally blind especially are really up a creek without a paddle. They aren't getting good advice. And, you know, as rehab counselors, you guys can also tell me, because I know when I was doing that job, we didn't have a whole lot of just people with tremendous abilities. The ones who had tremendous abilities had a good start, had a good family support system. And if they did have any help from someone in social work, it was when they were very young and they were on the right track already. That's why I think this whole transition program is something that needs to go lower and lower and lower in age in order to teach these kids responsibility, accountability, and everything else before they get to age 18, not after they get to age 30.
Yeah. Okay, we have another person, David.
That's okay. I just wanted to respond to what Ken had to say about the 28 versus the 22. And I think the secret is this. I don't know a whole lot of blind people who are working, but I do know that there are a lot of low vision people that are working. And I want to say this, that this is not rehab's problem. This is the employer's problem.
Jerry? Oh, did you want to say something?
Yeah. The microphone cord is so short, so it's right.
Yeah, actually, I had a couple of comments. You know, one, and they may lead to some resolutions. You know, I've been in this business a long time, and I remember back in the day when it was political poison with both the Federation and the Council to talk about blind people needing additional therapeutic services, particularly as to look at psychological, social issues, because the prevailing sentiment was we're just blind, we're not mentally ill, we don't have all these issues around, just deal with our blindness. And fortunately, I think that the attitude has changed definitely for the better. You know, anybody who's been in blindness services knows that there are just so many issues that impact both students. You know, we talked about congenital blindness versus folks who are adventitiously blind. There's just so many issues that go beyond blindness and the social fabric that we all grew up in or that we all have to deal with if we become blind later in life. We might consider a resolution strongly encouraging the department to either provide funding for, say, OCB, or to work with contract vendors like DPI or Living Skills to insist that at least somebody with a counseling background, particularly as a social worker, should be part of their staff.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's just a real critical issue. The other possible resolution, and I'm not really, you know, as you know, I'm really not involved closely with blindness services. However, I understand that the glucose strips for the advocate meter or the new low-cost glucose monitors are still not covered by Medi-Cal as far as their formulary. And I think that probably would be grounds for another resolution to urge the state to include those glucose test strips under their formulary for Medi-Cal. That's it.
Can I ask you if you'd write one of these?
Yeah, I'll work on it.
Would you really? For this convention or at least for the next one for sure?
Sure.
Oh, great. That's the kind of involvement we love. Okay. All right, here's Peter.
Yeah. You know, Jerry brought up some interesting points, and I thought I'd chime in. I remember speaking with the program manager for blind services when I was, you know, trying to secure a contract with the department. And when we talked about social work, it was like, no. Yeah, I heard the name. It's okay. And exactly like Jerry was saying, we're just blind. We're not all messed up in the head. And it was an insult to blind people to think because you're blind you need some type of therapy or some social work. But I'm not sure if resolution is appropriate because the department did, in fact, and I know this for a fact, contract with the Intercommunity Blind Center. What they called it was adjustment to blindness disorder. And it didn't work. I'm just telling you what has occurred. So what I'm saying is maybe a resolution asking the department, you know, to continue that direction might be appropriate. Unfortunately, the Intercommunity Blind Center has folded, and some of you may know that. And, you know, I could tell you right now, as a CEO for Blindness Support Services, we're looking at expanding and putting a satellite office, maybe not in Whittier, but in the neighboring area. But I do think, Patricia, that something to the effect of what we're talking about is important, and it should come from the advocacy groups.
Leo. Okay, and, you know, we really appreciate everyone's involvement in helping with putting together some of the writing of these things. It's if we disperse all the efforts, it'll make it easier to get things done. Did you
Oh, my name is Robert.
Okay.
In deference to social workers, I'm a counselor, and that's what I was trained to do, and I was trained to do psychotherapy, so we can help too. Anyway, one of the thoughts that I've had, and our workability contract really brought this to a head, is they came down and did an audit on the contract. And they started asking us about how we worked with the students and what we did, and one of the key things we noticed is many of the students had their employment plans written without any career exploration. No work was done. They weren't assessed. There was no work done with the student. So the student was just going in blind, as it were, not knowing everything they needed to know. And maybe that's one of the things we can look at, and maybe Blind Field Services might be a good place to do it, because it's a smaller population, and maybe we can kind of beta test it for the whole department as a way to go.
Yep. That's good. And once again, we appreciate your involvement, and to stay involved with us, please, as we build this committee.
I'm Kathy, and I'm a student at Orientation Center for the Blind, and because I have a good counselor, Tricia is my counselor, I have benefited from getting therapy paid for by the rehab department, which has helped me in my process of learning how to gain my independence and be, what do you keep saying, employment ready. And I think it, at my observation at the school is, you know, there are a lot of problems with, not with the teachers, as Trisha had said, because I'm definitely a big cheerleader for our instruction, as I know all the other students are. We have excellent instruction there. It's how things are run, and I think what I have observed is that, and I know for myself, I mean, I don't know that I'd be standing up here if Mike was still in the room. I don't mean to talk about behind his back. He's not a mean person, but I think I don't know what it's going to take. I feel like in issues that I've had to bring up there, that things fall on deaf ears, and so I think a lot of people give up. And so I've been talking with Trisha because I think we don't have a rehabilitation counselor on site that I think people feel safe with, and that's a huge problem. What I have observed is that people are the sense I get is that people are intimidated and afraid of, and think that one person there has a lot of power that's not true over their lives, over their future. So I've spoken with Mr. Chapson, is he here? Anyway, I've spoken with him, and he's going to, because I don't know what to do. I don't live at the dorms because I'm not comfortable with that situation, and so I live not far so I can get myself to school every day, and that's worked out well for me. But I don't know in my limited time there how to inspire people to want to get involved, to be feel empowered enough to be able to speak up. So that's the kind of help. I mean, I'm happy to try, and I just don't know what to do. I guess that's it. I just need some help and guidance on, well, how do I even go about making a change there. Resolution, yeah.
we always want to work with people first and see if they'll work with us. And thanks a lot, Kath, for doing all this and speaking your voice. And it's important. Not everybody has courage to speak up, and yet there's a lot of people behind doors that just don't come out because they don't know what to do sometimes, or they don't understand what kind of help they could get. And this committee is there for that reason. I mean, if some of the consumers want to meet with me as the chair of the rehab committee, I'm happy to hear them out. I can connect them. We could do a teleconference phone call with members of the committee, and the committee members can meet in general to say, we've got to do something about this. This is for the consumers. And sometimes we write resolutions. We'd like people to come to the table and just work with us. We'd like Mike, as of today, I did not feel either that he was really committed to working out a simple agenda of how to get accepted there, that we felt it was a little bit over the top, a little too strict to get in right now. And we'd like at least to sit down and discuss it with him. And we found that some of the other centers are easier to get into, and yet they still had a strict criteria today, too. So these are just some things. And then the employment issue we would definitely want to work on as well. And I want my consumers, when they go to OCB, to feel welcome and accepted. And the teachers have done that for my consumers. So I want to emphasize that once again, too, that the teachers are very good. And yet, you know, I think Mike needs to provide guidance where guidance is needed and set a tone where the tone is needed. And he's lucky to have teachers that will go in every day and set the tone and provide guidance to themselves. You know, that's not every employee will do that for an agency. Luckily, they're mature enough to do so. And he's lucky. Here you go.
I want to get back to that resolution that Jerry had mentioned. And Pete, I do understand what you're trying to say, but you know what? If we sugarcoat it, it's going to end up sugarcoating service. So I really do think we have to have a good, strong resolution for that. We could do it this time or even the next time around.
Yeah, that's why you guys are in the advocacy business.
And I'm not but I also, like I said, you know, Kathy, call me and have those consumers, if they will meet. I would be happy to set up a teleconference phone call with our committee, and a lot of the members in it are very supportive, kind people that would help brainstorm how we can assist to make things better.
I'm Abby Vinson, and because of the year I was born, I went through the system when it was very much different. But I was kind of hoping to hear, like with any other group, like in Los Angeles, everybody's really upset because black young men, there's a 50% unemployment rate, and we've got to do something, and it's not their problem, it's society's problem. But here, it seems like there's, 80%, maybe 70% of blind people are unemployed, but the thing that people seem to talk about is they have psychological problems. They don't know how to interview. They went through public school and didn't get an education, and that might be true of sighted people too. I don't know, but yeah, that is true. They have more options, and maybe somehow the whole blindness system ought to address the problem that we don't have a lot of options. Yeah, theoretically, you know, the sky's the limit. If you can dream it, you can do it. All you got to do is invent a way to do it. And, you know, I did my share of that. I worked at some conventional arenas like social work and computer programming and a little bit of part-time advocacy and teaching computers and that kind of thing. But really, I would like to hear more of, I guess the only thing that even approaches that is the job developer, where theoretically they're supposed to go out and develop jobs and find industries or, you know, careers that a blind person could do. But what they end up doing is telling the consumer, you know, well, you should really look in the newspaper to find the ads, that kind of thing. So I'd really like to have, at future conventions or maybe even this one, some more discussion about that. What about the whole social aspect of this?
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. You want to join our committee too?
I'll think about it.
Oh, no. Yeah. We love all involvement.
Hi, everyone. As somebody who lost their sight later in life, I sit here sometimes at these conventions and I listen to what everybody has to say about congenital blindness and other issues where it's hard to place people who have congenital blindness because they don't have the social skills and things like that. I graduated from DPI. And I'm not praising my husband's program. No, I'm not. And it did me a whole lot of good. But the thing is that I lost my sight late, and I worked 25 years as a nurse before that. And the thing I see with my rehab counselor, and don't get me wrong, I love my rehab counselor, but where he tries to stick me is factory jobs. And, well, he can manage us to find them. And when I first finished DPI and went through the Learning Center at Braille, the one spot he wanted me to go was Marriott. And yes, thank you very much. What I see and what I'm saying is I just think there's everybody says there's no jobs. There's got to be some way to come up with jobs for some of us who want to do consulting or who want to take what we've learned in the past and put it towards the future. There has to be some way to come up with something like that.
Yes.
Training.
Yes.
Yes.
But where? Delancey, come here.
Does anybody have any comments or any more to say?
Delancey.
Delancey. I don't want to keep you guys. Anybody else? I don't want to keep you guys too late into the day here. But what did you think? A little evaluation of our meeting today. What did you think?
It was good.
Excellent.
Yeah, very good.
Good job.
tell more people about us. We do want to help the consumers. That is our main focus. And I think that we can help start to deal with some things at OCB as well, just about, you know, hopefully just around how Mike will work with us on some of the issues and help set some guidance and tone.
Tricia, I'll try to come up with a draft by for the rehab committee on Saturday with this the resolution concerning the formulary for the low cost diabetic meter.
Okay, good. Wonderful. All right, that's the kind of enthusiasm we like. So.
Right.
All right, you guys, thank you all so much for coming today. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.